KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, San Francisco-based writer Venda Levita, author of And Now You Can Go, will be joining us to discuss her newest novel. It's called Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. Forum is coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum, our second hour. Venda Levita's newest novel begins with the protagonist Clarissa discovering that the man she believed was her father, who has just died, was not her biological father. Inside a book of Vargas girls is a birth certificate with the name of the man she assumes is her biological father, and thus begins an odyssey and a quest for identity that takes us up above the Arctic Circle to the Lapland terrain of reindeer, where the summer sun never sets and the winter sun never rises. Born and growing up here in San Francisco, Venda Levita attended Middlebury College and Columbia and worked at the Paris Review. Her first book was called Girls on the Verge, and it grew out of her master's thesis at Columbia, and was followed by a novel, And Now You Can Go. She's co-editor of The Believer magazine and a founding board member and teacher at A26 Valencia. Her newest novel, the second in a trilogy about the aftermath of violence, is titled Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name, and she joins us for this morning's second hour, and delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, I'm going to walk delicately here because I don't want to spoil the plot or give away anything here, but this is, I should say, both a search for a father and a mother as well, and this is a young woman who finds that she's, well, not only didn't have the same father she thought she had, but that at an earlier age in her life, or stage in her life, was abandoned by her mother, she and her Down syndrome brother. Let's talk, though, about how sympathetic did you want your character to be?
You know, I don't go into a book thinking too much about sympathy. I think about, well, I want to care for them, and ideally a reader will care for them, but are you saying that she's not sympathetic?
I cared for her. In fact, I found myself very moved by her, the sadness of her plight, mm-hmm. especially when I understood her history, which I think was clearly what you were getting at, right. for both her and her mother. But, you know, she's probably responsible for killing her cat. I don't want to give too many things away here. She seems so dissociated in many ways and so kind of angry at people for betraying her, particularly where the information about her father was concerned, mm-hmm. whereas probably they were trying to protect her, I would assume. You know?
Well, I also think that this is someone who just found out that her father just died, the man who's raised her. Her mom abandoned her in the family when she was 14, and she just found out that everything that she's thought about her life is completely apocryphal, meaning that she's just, you know, her father is somebody who lives in Lapland, someone she's never met, and this leads her on this odyssey to trace him down. Given all of that, I didn't think that she would have the sunniest disposition and be waking up, you know, being kind to everyone and sending them flowers or whatnot. So I think sometimes she can be a little disassociated and angry, and I think she has a right to be angry. I was interested in that. I was interested in her anger and in describing that. And I think there's a lot of anger that comes with death. When people die, there is this anger that is justified, and it expresses itself in ways that people never expect. And I wanted to communicate that and be truthful to that, and not think so much about whether or not she was being likable. I thought that maybe she was being likable sometimes in that fact that she could be humorous about
her.
She's
wry. Yeah, she's very wry.
But I wanted that her to be as true as possible.
Well, this does take us up to Lapland, and it takes us up to, is it the Sami people? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
Yeah, who are really an indigenous people, very much comparable in a lot of ways up there in that part of the world to Native Americans.
Yes.
And we get into a historical sense of a protest against the dam, and we get into, really, to some extent, the plight of this particular people. You did a lot of research, obviously, even the way they walk and stuff.
Yeah, I did do a lot of research. I first became interested in the Sami because my mother is Swedish. She's not Sami, but she's from the southern part of Sweden. And when I was growing up, I would hear a lot of stories about the Sami from my cousins. And in fact, one of my mom's cousins married a Sami man, and it kind of was part of the folklore in our family about how the Sami man had ridden into the wedding ceremony on a white horse, and how people at the wedding had yoked, which is kind of a form of Sami form of yodeling, but that's not quite doing it justice. They're these really beautiful prose poems that are sung aloud.
We have some of that in the novel, we should mention.
Yes, we do have some yoking. So I, from a very young age, when I was about seven, I became really interested in the Sami. In fact, I had a pair of Sami boots that I would wear around every winter. And it kind of, Lapland and the plight of the Sami started taking up the same part of my brain that fairy tales often inhabit. You know, I think there are stories you hear when you're young that just stick with you in a certain way, that stories when you're, you know, that you hear when you're older might not resonate as much. So I went to Lapland finally when I was about 29, and I went there with the intention of setting a novel there. I just knew that it was going to be the setting for something. And I went there in the summertime. I worked at a film festival up there, a really great film festival called the Midnight Sun Festival. And I liked it a lot. You know, during the summer, the sun never sets, and so people are partying all the time. It's kind of this hibernation culture where they sleep all winter and party all summer, and they party to such an extent that, like, I think I was walking across the street once, and two people threw up on me in the same minute. It's really excessive partying, and I bring that up to say that this is part of the reason why I thought, you know, I like this, and I can see why people like Lapland and are attracted to it, but I really want to see this in the winter. I'm more interested in the hibernation period here. And I also wanted to see more of the Sami culture, so I knew that I wanted to return in the winter and go even further north to where the Sami, there's a couple of prominent Sami towns like Kautokeino, which is in the northern part of Norway, and I knew I wanted to go back there.
Did you see a hotel made of ice and snow?
I did. I've been to two hotels made of ice. There's one in Jukkasjärvi, Sweden, and one in Alta, Norway, and I've been to both of them. Yeah.
So this had a kind of genesis as a fairy tale, then, in some ways.
And, it did.
Yeah. And then where did Clarissa enter into the picture?
Clarissa entered into the picture just as a question I had in my head. What would you do if you woke up one day and you've just been living a relatively normal life and you find out that you're not who you think you are? And I started with that question and the idea that I wanted to set it in Lapland. And those two ideas seemed to gel together in a lot of ways, because the setting of Lapland ended up helping me a lot, I thought, in just my own understanding of her emotional state. The bereftness and sparseness of the landscape kind of mirrors what's going on with her emotionally at the start of the book in particular.
Speaking about that sparseness, this is in some ways indicative of your prose style. It's been compared to Didion and Carver and writers like that. Mm-hmm. The economical, sparse quality of the prose, deliberate because of the character and because of the world you're trying to create?
Definitely deliberate. I don't write that way initially. I overwrite. This book was probably 100 pages longer, at least 100 pages longer when I first had a complete draft. And then what I do from there is I sculpt down, I get rid of words. And I once had a professor who said that when you're editing and going through the editing process, you should have a jar by your desk and put a quarter in the jar every time you delete a word. And sometimes with this book, I thought if I had actually done that, I'd be able to buy a new car or something. So I threw out so many pages, which is really frustrating as a writer, but I knew that's how I wanted the story to read. I don't know why, but it seemed wrong somehow to describe the landscape of Lapland with really lush, rambling sentences. And
it's the tundra, after all. Yeah,
and that's not the way I write to begin with.
But it's hard to give up some of that, particularly the more ornate and fluid prose that comes out of you. It's almost like pulling out intestines sometimes or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're really cutting out your insides in some ways, yeah.
A little bit, but I really wanted everything to be, what she's going through is very immediate, and I wanted the prose to reflect that. And she doesn't have a lot of time for reflection. She's finding a birth certificate. She's finding all these things. She's making plans. She's not going to sit there thinking about, you know, the history of mankind.
And yet she does self-reflect. I mean, you talked about how she's in a period of mourning, mm-hmm. and part of that is related to her grief, but yet at one point she says, my brain is a razor, it's a flesh-eating predator. I mean, as if somehow she really has become ignited by this quest as well. So both are operating.
Right, and I think she says that in response to, in the book, she's responding to the fact that people often question those people who are in mourning. They think, oh, they're not making the right decisions, they're confused, when in fact I think when people are going through a period of grief, they actually can have almost an adrenaline rush of seeing things with acute clarity. And I think that's what's happening with her here.
Talking of Edna LaVita, her new novel is Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. This is a part of what I would describe as an ambitious, you've described as trilogy, about violence and the aftermath of violence. Did you find yourself, I mean, there are violent episodes, of course, in the novel, but they take place in the past. They come out in part revelatory through the prose. Did you find yourself not wanting to write about these violent episodes?
That's a really good question. I did find myself having to force myself to write those scenes and to write them in really, just write a few sentences at a time, because it was really hard for me. It wasn't fun to write those scenes. And I tend to write before I go to sleep at night. And so I would just write a couple of sentences, put them away, you know, and try not to think about them and then go back. But it's really interesting. Those scenes did take me the longest time to write.
Something else that interested me, it's a little sidebar, but it's the sort of thing that in my strange anal retentive method of reading, I noticed. In your first novel, there's a student from Hungary, and in this novel, right away, there's this Hungarian florist, mortician, whatever. I mean, is there something about Hungary?
My family on my father's side is Hungarian, so I always like to put a little shout-out to Hungary.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just noticed those things.
Really,
I'm
funny.
That kind of reader.
No, thank you.
There is also in this novel a whole sense of travel. In fact, at one point, aphoristically, you say travel is made for liars, or liars are made for travel. And because she goes off to Lapland, and she's trying to find out her real identity, she's also able to invent herself, or mm-hmm. really create herself, isn't she?
Well, I think everyone's had that sense when you're on a plane, you're talking to someone, that you could be telling the person next to you anything you wanted and just kind of invent a new life for yourself, and they would never know. And I think Clarissa, who's never traveled much before going to Lapland, she never had a passport before, she'd never seen her birth certificate before. For her, it really is this freeing moment where she feels she could tell anyone anything. And also, she's feeling that she could be anybody, so why not just invent a past for herself and invent a new life for herself?
It's also scary up there. There's a moment, for example, where she goes out on a snowmobile and suddenly she realizes how vulnerable she is. In fact, she thinks, this man could do something really harmful to me. I hope he has daughters and nothing happens as a result. But there's that sense of paranoia on the one hand. And then when she meets a young man who plays a very important role, a reindeer herder.
Yeah.
She feels drawn to him, and she feels a sense of her loneliness and wanting to make human connection. So it's like you kind of really cover the range of her emotions mm-hmm. in terms of her seeking human connection, or seeking and fearing it at the same time. Yeah.
Well, there is something frightening about being in Lapland in the winter, because it's dark all the time. So you're kind of stumbling around the snow in the dark, literally without a lot of people around, a lot of reindeer. So I did want to convey that sense of fear, but also the sense of, I mean, it's also just incredibly mystical and beautiful and astounding. And so I tried to convey that as well.
Are you also trying to convey really the anesthetizing and traumatic effects, the kind of post-traumatic effects that come from women who've experienced violence or are survivors of violence?
Oh, definitely. And I think with both this book and with And Now You Can Go, my first novel, I was trying to, both of them have experienced kind of shock, and you know, that's the result of, in some way related to violence. And throughout the book, there's sort of a warming, hopefully, in both the revelations that come to them, and in the prose itself, where they kind of start to come to terms with what's happened and get over their past.
You must escape the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, for survivors or for victims, mm-hmm. whichever they are, I think is a really hopeful message. Isn't that what you wanted to convey?
Well, I think that in order to be an optimistic person, which I think I am, you have to believe change is possible.
There's a sense in the early part of the novel of time ticking away. I mean, it's not only that Clarissa has a job of writing subtitles and has to do it by the calibration of time, but also there's a lot of emphasis on what hour it is and time ticking and so forth. As the novel moves forward, that begins to dissipate somewhat. I don't know if that was intentional on your part or what you were trying to convey with it.
It was intentional. I wanted to show that when she's living in upstate New York and then living in New York City, she is very bound to time. And you're right, she's a subtitler for foreign films, and she gets paid by the minute. So if a film is, you know, 90 minutes, she gets paid a certain amount of it, as opposed to 2 hours. It's paid by the minute of the film, not by the amount of work she puts into it. And so she says she's forever counting time. And then when she arrives in Lapland, her whole sense of time is thrown out the window, because first of all, you can't tell what time it is by looking outside. I remember when I went to Lapland for the second time, I was so intrigued by how dark it was all the time that I found myself taking pictures of my watch, you know, holding my wrist up to the sky and taking a picture of my watch against the sky. And it was kind of ridiculous. I just came home with all these pictures of my watch, which meant nothing except that the sky was dark all the time. And so I wanted to show that when she does go to Lapland, the sense of time as she's known it completely goes out the window. Also, there's a whole saying in the Sami culture. They say we're on Sami time here, which means that time doesn't exist the way that it does other places. And so if you say we'll be there at 11, you could be there at 10 or 12. It doesn't matter. Time is more ambiguous.
Reminded me of a film which Al Pacino was in called Insomnia. Did you happen to see that?
I didn't see that. I deliberately didn't see that because people told me it was set, you know, I think it's set in Alaska or Canada.
In Alaska, yeah, but with a similar kind of northern sun and all, yeah.
Right, and I deliberately didn't see that.
But you experienced this on both seasons, I mean, in terms of your trips to Lapland, mm-hmm. yeah? So you got both sides.
Yes.
Yeah. Henrik, the reindeer herder whom we alluded to before, who plays an important role in terms of her discovery, along with the woman who's kind of a healer that we meet, a Sami woman, who also plays a very important role in terms of her identity, Anna Christine, I'm thinking of O'Neill's play, Anna Christie. There again, it seemed to me like you were working with some research. I mean, you were looking into sort of, I don't know, healers and natural kind of organic tribal women of healing proportions.
Yeah, that wasn't at all intentional. What happened was at a certain point when I was writing this book, I got really stuck. I had taken Clarissa to a certain point, and I didn't know what was going to happen next. I'm not the kind of writer who plots out everything in advance. I like to just kind of create a character and go with that character and try to figure out what he or she would do. And so I got midway through the book.
How much more exciting that is, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of exciting.
Because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So when I got really stuck, I convinced myself I was working if I planned a next trip to Lapland. So I spent a couple of weeks planning a trip in the winter, and I went with a friend of mine who's Norwegian. She served as a translator. And on this trip, we met a Sami healer, this really amazing woman who was a medicine woman. And I knew the second I met her, I was sitting there in her living room, and she was showing me pictures of her reindeer herding days when she had led a much more nomadic life. Now reindeer herding, the Sami still do a lot of reindeer herding, but it doesn't have to be as nomadic because they have snowmobiles and other things. But she was showing pictures of her travels when she was leading more nomadic life, and she was serving me reindeer meat. And I just knew at that moment that she was going to play a part in the book. She's not the exact character I met when I was in Lapland and sitting there in her living room, but I based a character on her, and this character ended up taking a much bigger role than I had originally intended.
But what good fortune to meet her. I mean, it just proves what novelists often say, that things come to you often when you don't expect them.
Or you go to Lapland.
Or you go to Lapland, right.
One or the other.
Is this the Sami people imperiled by the building of a dam? Was that actually, again, historical?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. And it would have flooded were it not for people protesting and chaining themselves, as we have described or chronicled in the book?
Right. The Sami people have, you know, like you were saying, they experienced a lot of the same plights as the Native Americans in this country. And so what happened was in the 50s, actually, the Norwegian government started devising a plan to build a dam in northern Norway that would generate more power for the rest of the country. And this was Sami territory, but you know, the government didn't pay much attention to that. And so in the early 1970s, when the plans became more put into focus, the Sami started protesting and literally chaining themselves to each other and blocking the roadway where the cars would have to go and the trucks would have to go in order to build the dam. And it actually was an interesting time for Sami people, because they were so nomadic and so disparate. They never really had ever grouped together before and identified as Sami and had a common Sami cause. So in some ways, it was really important for the formation of a Sami community. Obviously, not one that I think anyone would have wished, but it was the first time they all came together, and that was in the early 70s. And what would have happened had the dam been built is it would have flooded this really historic town called Maasi, which is
where Clarissa was conceived.
Right, which is where Clarissa finds out she was conceived. And so what happened was because of the Sami protests, they were able to stop the building of the dam at that time. It was built later, but it was redirected so that the town of Mazi was saved. And the other thing that happened with the building of the dam is that the Norwegian government told the Sami that they would be generating many, you know, thousands and thousands of jobs for the Sami people. And in fact, what ended up happening when the dam was finally built, I think 3 jobs were generated, and they went to people in southern Norway. So,
unfortunately, all too common a story where dams are concerned. She discovers, of course, without, I don't want to give anything away here, but that her roots are Sami. We won't go into more detail than that. Wouldn't she have looked more Sami? Was she able to pass as being not Sami?
You know, someone brought that up in a review recently, and what's interesting to me is that the Sami, and maybe I should have made this more clear in the book, there are some people who look really indigenous. There are some Sami who look, well, you know, more or less like what we think of Eskimos looking like. But there are other Sami who are blonde and tan and look like they could be live in Southern California. So it's a
Sami surfers.
Sami surfers. Something like that. But they're not so easily identifiable as a clan like that. In fact, in Helsinki and Oslo, there are many, you know, hundreds of thousands of Samis walking around, but you wouldn't know it because they don't look any different.
Now, you mentioned you read something in a review. You often say you don't read reviews.
I don't read reviews. In this case, I did. In this case, I was tempted, and I did.
There's also, and we should mention, you know, you. I guess it's well known, you and Dave Eggers are man and wife, that the two of you sort of shun the literary world at the same time that you've been kind of catapulted into a lot of spotlight in it. Didn't the San Francisco Chronicle once compare you as a couple to, I don't want to embarrass you, but Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston?
Stuff. I didn't know that.
Well, now you do. So you don't read the reviews, but
we're still married.
But that's the kind of side of literary recognition and literary fame that that doesn't thrill you, obviously. Why? A lot of people would welcome that. They would welcome the attention.
I think as a writer, you want to sit in your room and make up stories. You don't want to necessarily, I don't know, that's what you do. And what makes me happiest is teaching the students at 826 Valencia and hearing from readers every once in a while, and that's what I like to do.
Are you going to be appearing anywhere? Because certainly people who read you would like to see or
I think I'm doing a couple of readings in the Bay Area next week at Books Inc. on Van Ness and at Book Passage in Corte Madera and Cody's in Berkeley.
And McSweeney's is still the best place for breastfeeding in the city? Is that true?
The 826 Valencia Fish Aquarium. We found out, we didn't even know this happened, but there was there's a little aquarium with a couple of old movie seats in it, and it was voted, unbeknownst to us, as the best place to breastfeed in the city. And after that, I started to notice that there were a lot of women going in there with their babies and just watching the fish, and it's a calm place.
It can be a tranquilizing effect. Talking to Vandella Vida, and her new book is called Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. Certainly welcome your calls. Vandella Vida will be with us the hour, so if you would like to join us, if you've happened to have been a reader of hers, we'd certainly like to hear from you. If you would like to join in this conversation, wouldn't surprise me if there are people who have been up in this world of Lapland that is described so well in her new novel, or that know something about the Sami people. If you want to join us, please feel free on any level to do so. Our toll-free number for your calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. Again, the phone number to reach us at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with novelist Vandella Vida, and her newest book is called Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. And we were just talking off-air a little bit about names. Many of these names came out of her experience, of course, traveling up in that part of the world. And also phone book, yeah?
Yeah, whenever I travel, I try to look through the phone book just to get a sense of what kind of names there are. And, you know, I ripped out some pages from the phone books when I was in Lapland. And mainly because the names were so interesting to me, but also I wanted to make sure that when I was giving characters names that they were accurate and from that part of the world.
Well, we've got a caller from that part of the world, I believe. Tor, you're from Lapland?
Yeah, no, actually, near Lapland. I'm from a town called Tromsø.
Oh, it's in Norway, yeah.
Yeah, northern Norway, that's correct. And I certainly recognize a lot of the things you're talking about. I was actually thinking of calling in the other day when you were talking about dam buildings and the effect on the environment. And this dam that they built in Alta that impacted the Sami people a lot, that was, of course, a huge event in the late 70s. So I'm wondering about something else in that regard, and that is what you saw with environmental impacts in general, specifically global warming and the disappearing snow in that part, and how that affects reindeer herding and their way of life, as well as other impacts of the modern life and on that industry.
You have some thoughts about that, Vendela?
I don't know specifically that much about the reindeer herding industry. I do know that global warming has affected a lot. In fact, some of the reindeer herders I met with would have to take their reindeer out to islands every summer. They would take them across Norway and to islands out where you are, out by Tromsø, right, and leave their reindeer there for the summer and then bring them back in the winter. But they did, because of the global warming, because of changes in the climate, they were finding they had to change their migration patterns, and also they were finding a lot more mosquitoes, and that was really affecting their reindeer industry. But I'm not an expert by any means on reindeer herding.
Have you had reindeer meat?
I have. It's delicious.
I hear it's very good. I've never had it. All the vegans will get upset to even hear that they have reindeer eaten. But is there a place up there called Zero Point? What a great Point Zero. What a great symbolic name. Huh?
That is the actual place where the Norwegian government and the Sami protesters met on the road and kind of had this face to face battle about who would win.
Tor, thank you for calling. And by the way, if you'd like to join us here with Vendela Vida, our toll free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also email anything in the way of questions or comments, and the email address is forum@kqed.org. Roberta,
yes.
Welcome. You're on the air. Hi.
Okay, thanks. Hi.
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 I just came back from spending 4 months in Finland. I'm half Finnish, and there are 11 different languages in Finland, in Lapland, and it's my understanding that, for the most part, the Sami are indigenous white, one of the few white indigenous cultures.
That the Sami are?
Yes.
It depends which region you're talking about. There's northern Sami and there's southern Sami, and some do look very white, and some definitely look a little more indigenous. It's hard to say that they're all white. That wasn't my experience.
And this was in Inari.
Oh, I've been there. I love Inari.
Yeah, and they had a wonderful multicultural jewelry and art school there that anyone could go to if you were willing to learn the language. And I spent a week up there just doing research and showing them some of the research I'd done on indigenous peoples in other parts of the world.
Oh, great. And did you try to learn the language?
No. Too hard.
It is hard.
Did you?
It's really complicated. I did not try.
Finnish is hard enough.
Yeah.
The Finns don't understand the Sami. Okay, well, anyway, that was my comment.
Well, thank you for that comment,
Roberta.
Welcome
back.
Good of you to call. Yeah, welcome back indeed. This journey that your character Clarissa goes on, and by the way, it's Clarissa not for Mrs. Dalloway, but for Samuel Richardson's Clarissa, which I found kind of an interesting footnote. But this journey that she goes on, that she sets forward on, you really prepared us for, in a way, in a very deft way, if I may say so. Because earlier on, there's a man named Mr. Wells,
mm-hmm.
and he goes to San Antonio, and he was involved with her mother, and their mother disappears, and she takes this trip to find her mother.
Clarissa
with a
does.
Friend of hers named mm-hmm. Virginia. I mean, it's good plotting.
Thanks.
I assume, was... No, I mean, you said that things came to you with a medicine woman, but that mm-hmm. was plotted carefully, I think, wasn't it?
Well, it was plotted in the sense, again, it was me thinking about what this character would do. And if you're 14 and your mother takes off without a word, what happens is Clarissa's at the mall and they're shopping for Christmas presents, and they're supposed to meet up at the bakery at 7 o'clock, and again, their time reference, and she's 15 minutes late, Clarissa is, because she's buying a present for her mom. And when she gets to the bakery, the attendant there says, your mom said to say that she got tired of waiting. And Clarissa goes back home, and she and her father and her brother, they continue to wait for her mother, and she never returns. And, of course, they do all the, you know, things like, you know, file a missing persons report and all that, but they never find her. And so I was thinking, of course, if your mother disappears, you're not just going to never look for her or wonder what happened to her. And so the second that Clarissa does get a chance, when she has her driver's license and can find a friend to rope into her escapade with her, she goes to Texas looking for her mother because she knows that the man that her mother once had an affair with lives there now. And so she goes there looking for him and, of course, doesn't find her mother. But I wanted to set it up. But, of course, there was another time in her life when she was looking for her mother and finding the only clue that she could find.
And when she was willing to take off, which, mm-hmm. of course, she does. Why give her the brother with, I guess, Down syndrome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I gave her the brother with Down syndrome in part because, you know, it's a personal thing. I was once a caretaker for a boy who had Down syndrome. And I grew really attached to him, even though we couldn't communicate it at all. And I knew that I wanted to give Clarissa this brother character because there is something about, there's a theme of communication and not being able to communicate throughout the novel, throughout Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. And I try to emphasize that both with the language barriers and the fact that she does translation work, and yet she can't translate a lot of of what's going on in her own life or her own emotions. But I wanted to have someone in her life who she's close to but still can't fully communicate with. And that's, I gave her the brother also because I thought that I wanted the mother in some way to feel toxic. And I thought that it was very important for the formulation of the mother character to have her feel that she had given birth to a child that she felt she couldn't communicate with either.
Speaking of communication, at one point Clarissa asks a question, what kind of woman pretends to be asleep when her fiancé says, I love you?
Mm-hmm.
And again, you get into that sense of dissociation, which we do find out when we get a flashback, archaeological dig, linked to violence.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother's behavior, I assume, also has that cause and effect connection to violence.
Mm-hmm.
So it prompts me to ask you an obvious sort of question, and that is, how much is that important for you as an author to give weight to as a kind of didactic realization that women can be so terribly affected by violence?
I don't know how much I am consciously aware of it. I know the mother character grew out of the idea of being haunted by it since I was very young. When I was growing up, I had a friend whose mother had been raped. And there was a visible difference in the mother's attitude between before she was raped and afterwards. And she, she didn't laugh as much. She was much more serious. She was much more jumpy. And obviously it was something that she didn't know I knew, but I always wanted to ask her about it. And so when I was coming up with the character for the mother in this book, without giving too much away, I knew I wanted to create someone who had once been a certain way and had some event happen in their life that had altered their personality. And I was influenced by that experience growing up on an emotional level, and then on a more academic level, if you will. I read an essay by Galen Strawson that was published in Ratio magazine. He was talking about his belief in episodics. There are a small percentage of the population who don't see the past as in any way connected to their current lives. And he, Galen Strawson, was saying that he defines himself as an episodic. But, of course, as a writer, that seems so foreign to me. I'm someone who's constantly trying to find bridges and connections and narratives. I was really attracted to that idea. And so all these different factors kind of contributed to creating the mother character. And for me, it was the issue of violence that would define her, the separation between her past and her current life.
But in a sense, through Olivia, the mother, you were trying to figure out your friend's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And this episodic theory comes from whom again?
Galen Strawson. He's a philosopher who I wasn't aware of until we interviewed him in The Believer, which is the magazine that I co-edit. And he was in our first issue, and he's someone who doesn't believe in free will. And since I first read the interview, I was really interested by what he had to say, and I came across some other essays he had written and was drawn to them.
I'm just reminded, I think I've mentioned this before, a long time ago I interviewed the Nobel laureate Isaac Bashevis Singer and asked, do you believe in free will? And he said, I have no choice.
That's
one of the memorable lines, line that you certainly remember. Michael Cunningham has said some very good things about this novel. How did it come to his attention?
That was just, I don't know him. It was just a really fortuitous thing. I've always been a fan of his work, particularly The Hours, and I thought of him when I was writing this book because the character in my book is named Clarissa, and obviously in The Hours, He has a character named Clarissa because he's paying tribute to Mrs. Dalloway, as you said, and Virginia Woolf. And I believe, actually, I think I remember reading somewhere that Virginia Woolf was inspired to name her character Clarissa after Samuel Richardson's Clarissa. So I thought of him because of that, and someone I know sent it to someone they knew who sent it to someone who they knew, and somehow it got to Michael Cunningham and came back with this.
You do feel those hours ticking away at the beginning of the novel. Here's a listener named Autumn, interestingly enough. Your child's name is October. Mm-hmm. Says, why do you think the northern parts of the world seem so fascinating to some people? Well, most people want to go to tropical places to hang out in the sun. Some of us seem very drawn to places like Iceland. What are your thoughts?
I don't know why it is. For me, I'd much rather go someplace cold and mystical than someplace hot and tropical. But maybe that's because I'm part Swedish. I do think there is an interest lately in, you know, obviously Iceland has become a lot more popular as a place to go to, and I've been there and been astounded at how many Americans there are there. But I can't answer that except that they are amazing, amazing cultures with a lot of history as well.
You mentioned, though, your father's being Hungarian. Are you sort of drawn to that culture as well, despite giving a shout out? I mean, are you giving a shout out? Or is it just mainly the Swedish and Scandinavian world?
Maybe in a future book I'll be attracted to the, you know, Hungarian part of the world. I haven't written about Hungary yet. Sweden I wasn't always that interested in. When I was growing up, I was interested in the Sami, but other than that, I wanted to be Italian. You know, I kind of shunned my Swedish heritage and I embraced it as I got older. But I think that everyone goes through those periods of
wanting to be something else.
Yeah.
You have, I did read some of the reviews of your book, and some of them pointed out, a couple of them pointed out your eye for detail. Quite favorably, with approbation. Talk about that as a novelist. I mean, when you go into and you isolate yourself and the story starts coming out of you, where the details come in, or why the details, or how the details come in.
I think it comes a lot from something I teach my students at A26 Valencia when I'm teaching writing classes is, you know, when you want to describe something, you don't look for the obvious details. So say if you're describing a chair, you don't say, oh, it has four legs. You describe, you know, maybe there's something weird with the fourth leg. Or you always look for the unobvious thing, and that's the thing that sticks in your head. So because I teach that, I feel like I have to actually do that as well. It's a reminder to me. And so when I'm traveling, I definitely have a notebook out and take notes, things that I think are odd or interesting or unusual, and I always try to include those in my writing.
Talk a little bit about the teaching side of your life. It's very important to you, obviously, mm-hmm. and do the two work in sync, that is, the writing and the teaching?
Oh, I think they work really well together. I teach mostly because no one wants to be in their room alone writing all day long. That would be awful. You know, you're all by yourself and you don't have any contact with the outside world. And
except Kafka, who said he wanted
that. Okay, no one. I shouldn't say no one. I don't want to be in a room by myself all day long. And so, and also you want to feel that you want to get other people excited about writing and reading. And so with the students at A26 Valencia, I taught two classes this past fall. I taught an international fiction workshop, which is more like a book group in which we read Murakami and François Sagan, and now we're reading a Hungarian novelist, Zsuzsa Bank, who wrote an excellent book called The Swimmer. And I also teach a class on writing the college admissions essay, which is something that I believe really strongly in, namely because when I was growing up applying to colleges, I had no one to turn to. My mother had grown up in Sweden and didn't really understand the college system here, and my father unfortunately never had the means to be able to afford to go to college, and so I found myself at a loss. And so I think what I'm trying to do by teaching this class every fall is try to provide some input and some help to these students in helping them formulate their college essays.
This has been ongoing now at Valencia for how long?
We're celebrating the fifth year this April.
And some real success stories, I mean, in terms of kids who didn't seem like they were headed toward college and wound mm-hmm. up there, or certainly wound up writing and being dedicated to writing, yeah?
Definitely. I feel really excited, especially now that we've been around for 5 years and I have some of my students who have headed off to college and come home over in the breaks and we get together and they tell me what's going on. They're really excited about it, and it's really fun for me.
talking again with Vanda Levita, whose new book is Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. I'd said in my introduction that you worked at the Paris Review. You got to know Plimpton, did you?
I did. I worked there a long time ago. I was right out of college, and I got an internship working there, and I continued to work there for about 2 years.
What'd you do?
The Paris Review is a really interesting place because they give a lot of valuable work to interns. You know, it's not just licking stamps and things that you know, I guess you don't lick stamps anymore anyway, but you don't, it wasn't just, you know, stamping envelopes. You actually got to edit manuscripts and give your 2 cents on things that came through the slush pile, namely, you know, things that were...
Some over the transom.
Over the transom, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you were really kind of keyed into editorial process, yeah.
I was getting an introduction to it, yeah.
And now have been working with this magazine, Believer, for how long?
We started the Believer in March of 2003. So we just published our 40th issue.
Tell me more about it.
The Believer is a monthly magazine, and it has long book reviews and interviews with writers and artists and musicians. And it sounds, in some ways, in long essays, when I describe it like that, it sounds like a lot of other magazines, I suppose.
Like Paris Review.
But we said we don't publish fiction. That's one thing we don't do. There's the Paris Review, at least it used to be, under Plimpton, primarily a venue for fiction and poetry. But what we try to do is we don't have any limit on length, and so we can, and we don't have to be timely. We have no obligation to anybody except for ourselves. Me and my 2 co-editors, Heidi Julevitz and Ed Park, who were both classmates of mine at Columbia.
Is Heidi Julevitz also Paul Auster's?
No, that's Siri Husvedt.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Good Scandinavian name.
Yeah,
lots of
Scandinavians. And so we wanted to kind of continue the conversation we'd had when we were younger about books and unknown books and writers and artists that we admired. And so we thought, well, let's start a magazine and let's try to, you know, expand and continue this conversation with our readers and with a wider audience, because we want to know what's going on too. And so we publish reviews of books that are published by small presses, and we run long articles about books that might have been published 60 years ago and you never heard of, but, you know, we have a writer who says, oh, you should have heard of this book, and we say, okay, write about it for us. And so I feel really grateful that we're able to exist at all, and that, you know, we owe that all to our readers.
And funding is from the readers?
It's from the readers, yeah. We managed to pay our writers a small amount, but we managed to pay them, and we haven't had to turn to any outside funding yet.
Great. We're going to go to some more calls here. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org. By the way, I was just remembering that last we had George Plimpton on, to my surprise, he turned out to be an expert on pyrotechnics and explosives. That's why he was on. We were talking about explosives, and so and George Plimpton.
Yeah, he would throw some great 4th of July parties where he would actually be the person doing the explosives. Yeah.
We're going to bring some more of our callers in. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Morning.
Good morning. I am wondering, what is your name, the author?
Vendela Vida.
Vendela Vida.
Vendela is the first name. Vida is the last name.
Vendela. Okay. I have a question about the fringes of the new upcoming European countries like Romania and, Ireland is not new, but at the west of Ireland, which is still very wild and the old language exists and how the languages come together now. If you know, if you have an interest in what is happening as of now with those 2 languages being added to the official European languages, like Gaelic, Romanian?
Right. Well, I do think it's really important for these languages to be preserved. I'm more interested in it from a literary standpoint, and I'm really excited about a book that's coming out in March. Anchor Books is publishing a collection called Words Without Borders, and it's a book of translated stories from different parts of the world. Like you've mentioned, there's a story from Romania, and there's a story, I believe, from a Gaelic story, although I might be mistaken, that's been translated. And I'm not by any means an expert on languages, but I'm really interested in the literature that comes out of these countries and our access and our ability to read these stories in English. It's something that I really like to see, and it's something we try to do at The Believer, but obviously it's a really expensive process, and I'm happy that this book is coming out.
Mary, thank you for the call. We did a whole program a while back on indigenous peoples and the preservation of language. I mean, the preservation of those languages in many cases all too difficult to preserve and going by the wayside really ultimately reflect the preservation of their history, of their culture, mm-hmm. of everything they have stood for and everything they've been. I mean, it should be a more zealous campaign, if I can editorialize here for a moment. I'm sure you understand.
Yeah. It was also interesting to me, one thing that is happening now in Lapland is that the schools there, they're once again teaching Sami in the schools. That was something that the Norwegian government didn't allow up until the 60s. In fact, the students there were sent away to boarding schools where they were taught Norwegian and not Sami. But now people in all parts of the country, all parts of Scandinavia, are embracing Sami. In fact, it's kind of considered like a cool thing for kids in Helsinki and Oslo to study Sami as their second language.
You think of Norwegians being more enlightened, but they do sometimes cross over in strange ways. There was recently a news story that I found very strange. In Norway, they were instructing boys to urinate by sitting on a toilet seat for some notion of equality or gender equality. Uh-huh. You know, this is Norway. Let's go to more of your calls. Court, morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from Napa.
Yes, welcome.
And in 1970, when I graduated from high school, my Finnish grandparents took me on a trip to Finland for the summer. And I was just wondering if you encountered a similar situation. One of my Finnish cousins married a Sami, and it was considered kind of a scandal. And there was a general feeling that the Sami were second class to the Finns.
And what year was that?
1970.
Yeah, that definitely is something. It's still, there's definitely still that feeling when you go there, and I think that's changing now. In fact, now there's actually been a reversal to the extent that people are kind of embracing the Sami culture in the sense that if you look at fashion magazines and that are coming out of Stockholm and Oslo, they often dress their models in Sami clothes. Huh. And then, of course, the month later, there'll be protests in the letters section saying, that was really great that you dressed your models in Sami clothes, but next time maybe you could use Sami models, too. But, yeah, you definitely get the sense of discrimination and up there.
But it's everyone's in Vogue now. It's more chic.
It's more chic, but it's...
Are they trying to walk around bow-legged? Or? I mean, you mentioned in your book that there is a kind of Sami walk.
That's actually a stereotype that the Sami walk with bow legs. And I talked to a couple of Sami about that, and they said it was because they used to not have enough fresh vegetables and they wouldn't get enough vitamin D, I think it was, and that would cause their muscles to not form correctly.
They get rickets, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
interesting. And I just also curious about, are you aware of the connection between Hungarian and the Finnish language, and it's the only two languages that are actually related in the world?
I do know that. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Genghis Khan is supposed to be our common forebear.
I don't know what that explains, but thank you for that. Here's a listener, Kim in Santa Clara, says, what are your thoughts about free will in response to the author that was interviewed in the first issue of The Believer?
Oh, God, can I steal that quote that you were saying earlier?
The Isaac Singer quote?
I don't have to believe in free will. I don't have a choice.
No, that'll work. But do you know the first issue, who the author was? Because this listener didn't remember who was interviewed about free will.
Oh, it was Galen Strawson.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned the episodic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let me get more of your calls on. Stephanie, hi.
Oh, hello. This is a wonderful guest and very, very interesting. And I have a question about her travels to Iceland. I saw a documentary once about the Icelandic people's belief in gnomes and elves. Did she find that when she went there, and was it reflected in their literature?
First of all, thank you. I did see it reflected in the literature, and also I was actually surprised at how prevalent it was. I was traveling around with a woman who was 30, and she also was talking about the gnomes and their, you know, their beliefs in there. And I've seen it in films, too. I think in 101 Reykjavik, there's some talk of it. And also in a really beautiful small film called Dís, which is an Icelandic film, there's some mention of it as well. But I think that's what really attracts me to that part of the world. There is this sort of mystical element that exists, and people don't ridicule it. It just kind of it just exists alongside their culture and with their culture.
Let me try to get another call on. Donna, that's you. Hi.
Oh, hi. I have much less exotic questions, more nuts and bolts. How did you get your first book published? Was it through your connections at Paris Review? Did you have an agent? And who published you now?
My first book kind of was an accident, actually. I started it writing an essay when I was at Columbia. First book was called Girls on the Verge, and it was about female initiation rituals in the United States, and I explored rituals as diverse as debutantes coming out and young girls who are interested in Wicca, witchcraft, and young brides who are getting married in Las Vegas. So basically, I was interviewing women who are on the cusp, girls who are on the cusp of womanhood, and the rituals that they went through to try to make those transitions official. The book came out, it was so long ago now. I put together these series of essays, and an agent in New York heard about it, and she asked to see it, and then she asked me to completely rewrite the book, and I did. And the first book was published by St. Martin's, and the second book was, And Now You Can Go, was published by Knopf, and this current novel, Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name, is published by Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins.
Thank you for the call. And Now You Can Go is still out in print, we should mention.
Yes.
It begins with a redheaded man with a gun and a character named Ellis, whom we learn a great deal about. And so there's, again, you know, violence and the aftermath. And the third one is in the works, yeah?
The third book.
Well, you're going to write a trilogy,
I think. You know, I'm so embarrassed I actually ever said that. I think it was just in my own mind. I knew I was setting out to write a trilogy because I'm a huge Philip Roth fan, and I really admire the way that his three books, Human Stain, American Pastoral, and I Married a Communist, can all stand on their own, but when you read them together, they're actually add up to more than the sum of their parts and kind of have a conversation with each other. So I knew when I was setting out to write, when I started writing this book, and I found, right, this book being Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name, and I found that it had similar themes to And Now You Can Go, I was thinking about how they're both exploring violence and its aftermath, but with different resolutions. And the book I'm currently working on is set in Turkey. And again, it's about violence and forgiveness, but you will have a different ending, a different take. And hopefully these books can be, I can look at them and think they're having some conversation with one another.
Well, it's been a delightful conversation with you this morning. I appreciate very much your being with us. And the Levitas book, Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. We'll be back with you on tomorrow, talking with biologist and researcher Bruce Ames tomorrow and hearing from a local singing group called Vocalot. Hope you will join us for that. Remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or suggest what you'd like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Our thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Dave Freeman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.